and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, we continue our regular weekly segment called Women and Society with Professor Hannah Dickinson. We focus on the controversy over Joe Biden's pattern of inappropriate conduct towards women, and we look at the policies that have affected women throughout the decades by Joe Biden as a U.S. senator and in his position as vice president during the Obama era. And then we continue our regular segment called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. According to Saudi officials and the Washington Post, Jamal Khashoggi's four children are now being provided million-dollar homes in Saudi Arabia and monthly payments of at least $10,000 each. This arrangement was approved late last year by King Salman. The officials say that the arrangements are for, quote, ensuring that they continue to show restraint in their public statements about the killing of their father by Saudi operatives, close quote. The United States has stopped the delivery of F-35 stealth fighter aircraft to Turkey, stating that they won't deliver the weapons without a clear decision that Turkey is forgoing Russia's S-400 missile defense system. The F-35 is built by weapons giant Lockheed Martin. Turkey has said that it will have the S-400s delivered in July. Senator Bernie Sanders has now raised $18 million since launching his presidential campaign, with an average donation in February and March of only $20. A majority of his contributors are under 39 years old and gave under $200. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular weekly segment called Women and Society. We talk to Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Professor Dickinson is an educator. She is also an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. She joins us from Geneva, New York. And we're joined here in studio by Nicole Roussel. She is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. Hannah, Nicole, welcome back.
Thanks.
When I was walking into the studio, I was noticing the 7 or 8 television screens, some of them in our studio. Some of them have MSNBC, some of them CNN, others Fox. There's one image on all of them right now, and that's former Vice President Joe Biden. And of course, the allegations that he inappropriately touched women, political figures, and perhaps many, many others over not just the last couple months or couple years, but over a long, long time. It's become a big political issue because Biden has not yet announced that he is a candidate for the 2020 presidential election. But should he announce, I believe the Democratic Party establishment will view him as the absolute favorite. So what happens here has an impact on 2020. Hannah, what are your feelings from the last couple of days?
Yeah, it's perplexing to me how in this moment the Democratic Party could believe Joe Biden is the favorite or that he would run, frankly. So, I mean, already his participation in the Anita Hill hearings, you know, as chairperson of the Judiciary Committee, like already for so many feminists and women who've been involved in movements for equality for decades, right, already had concerns. And so these stories about, him touching or kissing women who haven't invited or, you know, given permission for that kind of touching.
Or rubbing his nose with their nose. What
weird
is that?
I still love sniffing their hair the best. But Hannah, you're right. And the funny thing is that none of this is new. He's been doing this for decades. So it's amazing to me that he hasn't changed that behavior, despite the fact that for decades, people have said that they have been offended by it. And now in 2019, the news networks are saying, oh, my goodness, this might be offensive behavior.
Yeah.
We're shocked.
But it is a consequence of the fact that the Me Too movement and the movement that has taken root in the United States but has spread worldwide has made conduct like this an issue where in the past, in the past it wasn't.
It was overlooked.
Yeah. Go ahead, Hannah.
Yes, for sure overlooked. But a part of the discourse around what's going on with DeWitt in the last few days that I just find really disappointing is all this stuff about, oh, it's just because he's like the grandpa or like your uncle, or that's just Joe being Joe. He's always been like that. So in some ways, right, as troubling as the uninvited touching, hair sniffing, nose touching might be, equally troubling, I think, is that Democrats who claim to stand up for women and women's rights and be meaningful participants in the Me Too movement are giving him a total pass with a set of excuses that, you know, women activists, feminists have been fighting for decades, right? In some ways, right? Since those Anita Hill hearings and before. That just is so weird to me.
Yeah. You know, Nicole, one of the things, I mean, there's so much, there actually is a lot to this issue. It's, you know, what the media is focusing in on is Joe Biden's conduct, right? And of course they should be, because women are coming forward and saying, look, this happened and we objected and it wasn't appropriate. And then there's another level, which I think Hannah's also alluding to, which is the deeper issues, not deeper, but other deep issues, including what has Joe Biden's record been when it comes to actually defending women's rights, or in the case of Anita Hill, defending or supporting women who are making allegations of serious sexual misconduct and abuse by powerful men like Clarence Thomas, who was shielded by Joe Biden. And in his role as a Democrat, as chairperson of the House Senate Judiciary Committee in October 1991. And then there's another part to this. Joe Biden was vice president for Barack Obama. Do you remember in the 2010 or 2011 budget negotiations with John Boehner, who was then Speaker of the Republican House Majority? There was a, you know, none of the Republicans wouldn't allow the Obama budget to go through. And so there was a compromise at the end. And at the end, Barack Obama came into the meeting and he said, you give me this budget and in exchange, I'll give you abortion in D.C., meaning that the Democrats would go along with disciplining and prohibiting the District of Columbia Council from providing Medicaid funding for low-income women who were using abortion facilities. So Obama and Biden, because they were the administration at that time, quote, I'll give you abortion, as if women's rights are something just like a trading.
They're just a playing card.
A playing card.
Yeah. And which is exactly what Biden did in the Anita Hill hearing, right? He made a deal with the Republicans because they knew this was going to be very damning for Clarence Thomas, because there were five women lined up to testify about harassment, about really unprofessional and harassing conduct in their places of work with Clarence Thomas. So Joe Biden, as the chairman of this committee, went in with Republicans at the last minute and made a deal. And the deal was that those people would not testify, just Anita Hill. So it was one person against another person. He said, she said, rather than five people coming out and addressing all of the awful sexual harassment cases. It's the same thing. It's just throwing women under the bus for what I guess they assume are bigger political issues, but they're not, because women, to my understanding, are also people.
Yeah, it's the old boys club too, Hannah.
Well, that's just what I was going to say, Brian, is, you know, speaking of Anita Hill, part of that deal, right, the congresswomen spoke up and said, come on, Joe Biden, we have to hear from these women. And his response was, I'm a man of my word. I told the Republicans I wouldn't do this. And so I've got to stick to it. Right. So I think we can see very clearly how he understands that government works. You stick with the boys. So I think it's a real problem here. And again, I am just baffled that in a moment when women are speaking up and men of conscience are speaking up, and we're having meaningful conversations about sexual harassment in the workplace, as well as rape and sexual assault, domestic violence, and how, I mean, and not just the behaviors, right? How this structure of patriarchy and misogyny is, right? Structures our government and structures our society. And, right, that's where people are. And then the response is, oh, but it's just like your uncle. No, you, like, uncles don't get to touch you when you don't want them to either. It's so weird.
That's called child abuse, right? I mean, there are plenty of kids taken away from family members when they do stuff like that. It's not okay.
Let's talk about the Anita Hill hearings. One of the women, Nicole, came from her hospital bed. I mean, these women came all the way from wherever they were to Washington, and Joe Biden could have allowed them to testify at the hearing. And he stopped them.
That's the most egregious part of this, I think.
Well, and now he's trying to pretend like, you know, his quote now is, I wish there was something I could have done.
Yeah.
You know, she had to speak in front of all these old white men. And I wish that there was something that I could have done to make this a hearing that she deserved. The hearing that she got was not what she deserved. She deserved better. But he was in total control of that. He was in 100% control of that. And we even have Nancy Pelosi coming out this morning saying, I don't think it's disqualifying, referencing his behavior, and women coming forward and saying his behavior was not welcome. She goes on, he has to understand in the world that we're in now that people's space is important to them, and what's important is how they receive it and not necessarily how you intended it. So this is more commentary, just like his, which was, you know, I never intended it to be what people perceived it as. It doesn't matter. And that's always been the case, that it shouldn't matter what the intention is. You have to understand what the impact was, right? You have to be able to hear from someone else what the impact was and then stop doing that behavior. But instead, we have decades of Biden doing the same thing.
Well, and we also have this quote from Pelosi, right? Part of the same statement where she says, he's an affectionate person to children, to senior citizens, to everyone, but that's just not the way. So again, as if you behave inappropriately toward the elderly and children, then it's not sexist. There's, this interest in willingness to excuse this behavior on the part of other Democrats. But I think you're right, Brian, is about their belief that he's the best candidate. But not only is that a misguided belief, it's also a really opportunistic, cowardly response to this. Stand up and say it is time that the Democratic Party is the party that stands up for women and stands up against sexual assault. We are done running candidates that have any of this kind of baggage or any insinuation around sexual assault. This is not about litmus tests in some opportunistic political way. This is us saying we know our base is women and we stand with them and are done participating in the U.S. government being part of
the problem.
Yeah. And we're just not seeing that.
But the Democratic Party should have learned this long ago. The women have been standing up and saying this for a long time. And we had, you know, the last Democratic president before Obama was Clinton, just as bad, if not worse. Right. I mean, this is something we shouldn't have to tell them this, you know, every single year, every single presidential run. This is something that they're either going to learn or they're not. And from what I see, they're not going to learn, because their goal is to keep power. Their goal is to make sure that they get somebody in office who can manage the affairs of this upper rung, this upper echelon of wealthy people in the U.S. And Biden's great to do that, right? He's happy to make compromises and throw women under the bus as long as he can keep his corporate ties, which we know he has, you know, to various corporations rather than dealing with the actual issues of his constituency.
Well, you know, we talked, Nicole, before this show, we talked at our editorial meeting about how the Democrats, and Nancy Pelosi in particular, were trying to set things up in the 2020 campaign so that Medicare for All would not become the policy position of the Democratic Party. Now, most Americans favor Medicare for All. They have for a long time. And anyone who is paying for private insurance right now, if you're working class or low income or even middle class, you would greatly, greatly benefit from Medicare. And yet the Democrats aren't going to do it. So the question is, why? If it's going to be so successful politically, why won't they do it? It's not because it's going against the grain. Again, the majority actually supports this. It's because it's going against their real constituents, who are the private insurance companies, who are the banks, who are Wall Street. I mean, this is a ruling class party.
I mean, we saw a piece that we talked about here on the show just a couple of weeks ago that I think was in the New York Times or maybe the Washington Post, but outlined the same thing, right? That like the profits, you know, that Medicare for All would be terrible for the country because, and they effectively outlined that the pharmaceutical, or excuse me, the insurance companies wouldn't be making the same amount of money anymore and that that would be catastrophic. But you know what? I actually don't think that would be catastrophic. I think if people had the healthcare that they needed and we trained people who worked at health insurance companies right now for whatever state-run health insurance and trained other people to work on green jobs and to fill potholes and to work on, have more teachers in education. You know, my mom's high school, for example, doesn't have a counselor, no counselor, no nurse. Why don't we train people to do those things and put them into those jobs? Right? I mean, there are plenty of jobs to go around. And if that's the real issue, then we can fix that. But that's not the real issue. The real issue is that the health insurance companies are in the pockets of Congress. And so that's clearly the real issue to me.
Well, and as we talked about last week, we also know that Medicare for All would significantly improve not just the health outcomes, but the independence of women. Right. And so, I think we're seeing an example here of how in the Democratic Party's attempt to hold on to power and maintain a government by and for the ruling class, that, again, women are thrown under the bus. Right. As we were saying before, as bargaining chips, but also, right, just no recognition that we're not interested in holding up one woman or two women or supporting women CEOs or saying we've made it because a woman's the head of the CIA, right? We're talking about what the vast majority of women need. And again, Joe Biden's not delivering that and the Democratic Party is not delivering that.
And he never has because he got into office through opposing busing, right? Which, as we've said on the show, all issues are women's issues. And busing, the one thing that could potentially have ended segregation in schools, is totally a women's issue. There were Black girls, schoolgirls who wanted to go to school and get a good education who were on those buses that Biden opposed, right? Like, this is for sure a women's issue. He also voted for the Iraq War in 2003, sending, you know, tons of U.S. troops into harm's way, breaking up families for those troops that had to leave. I mean, war is also a women's issue. All of these things he voted very, very badly on.
And I was thinking of 1994 earlier because I was thinking of something Joe Biden actually did do, which was the big, big champion of the criminal justice reform bill. When you look at the number of people, including the number of women in jail and in prison since that bill in 1994, it's gone exponentially up. And Biden today still says that's one of his leading achievements, right?
He said as recently as 2007, it was his, quote, greatest accomplishment. I think now that, you know, we have this reform era that's beginning to really clamp down on what were really terrible policies. I don't know that he's saying that now, but as recently as 2007, I mean, that was 15 years later. And he was still saying, you know, that this was his greatest accomplishment when what it did was put more and more and more people in jail and prisons. And now we're seeing a huge skyrocketing percentage of women going to prison. And a lot of the prison or a lot of the crimes we're seeing people go to prison for and we're seeing women go to prison for are, you know, stemmed from abuse towards women. We're seeing, you know, women go to prison for not being able to feed their kids because they don't have money or not being able to defend themselves, or they do defend themselves like Marissa Alexander by shooting a gun in the air and then going to prison for having assaulted or threatened to assault the man who was abusing her. I mean, these are the kinds of things we're seeing women increasingly, very quickly, increasingly going to prison for.
And John, you are aware as an ex-prisoner and certainly as someone who follows prison issues and fighting for prison reform
closely,
the conditions of women in prison since 1994 have deteriorated
dramatically.
Women are shackled routinely. That's the federal prison policy during childbirth.
During childbirth, that's correct. That's correct. And, you know, there are a lot of documented cases just in the last, you know, 6 or 12 months of women being shackled while receiving medical treatment and dying while they're shackled. Now, they're shackled because there's supposed to be some kind of an imminent threat to the public safety, which is preposterous, just like it's preposterous to shackle a woman while she's in the midst of childbirth because she's supposedly some sort of a threat to the public safety. But we see that all the time. You know, this show, Orange is the New Black, it started off as as a comedy. It was nominated for a bunch of awards as a comedy. There was nothing funny about that show at all. And the book was quite depressing. And then they sort of rebranded it as a drama. The reason I watched that show, which, believe me, I'm going to reveal something here, it triggers PTSD in me. But I feel like I have to watch the show because even though it's sort of Hollywoodized, they raise a lot of very important issues in Orange is the New Black. One of them is that women are not provided free access to sanitary products. Now, that's absolutely insane. So if you've got somebody on the outside who can put $300 a month in your commissary account, you're probably okay.
Great. Then you don't bleed through your pants. But if you don't...
What if you're poor? What if you don't have anybody on the outside? What if you're homeless? I can't tell you the number of homeless people I was in prison with.
And can you tell us, they didn't mark up things when they were selling them inside, did they?
Oh, yes, they did. In fact, there's a formula that they use. You pay 30% over retail, and then that 30% is supposed to go to buy gym equipment or books for the library. In fact, I can't begin to tell you how many times I saw delivery trucks come to the prison to unload giant screen TVs and workout equipment for the guards' lounge. That's where that money goes. In the meantime, there's no money to buy sanitary products for women. And that's common across America. That's a normal thing in prisons across America. You think prisons are bad for men. They're worse for women.
Well, and we're now seeing overcrowding, right, with this huge increase in numbers of women. There's far fewer, in total, there's far fewer women who are incarcerated. So when you have one prison in the entire state that houses women, you have right now huge over-incarceration, huge overpopulation problems. Or, you know, in Louisiana, when I was working down there in the criminal justice system, during the flooding, you know, there was constantly lots of flooding happening. If any flood came near the women's prison, you would have to evacuate everyone and put them into solitary cells in men's prisons because you can't be in the general population. So then you're in solitary for literally just being female.
Yeah.
You're in solitary.
Absolutely.
Or if it's overcrowded, even without the flooding, you can still get sent to solitary just for your own protection.
I know Brian wants to move on, but I want to add one more thing. My prison was very typical. It was just a normal, typical, average, low-security prison. It was built for 675 people. We had 1,425 people in it when I was first sent there. So they double and triple up in the cells, and then they put bunk beds in the hallways, right, just to jam as many people in as possible. Your point, Nicole, is an important one. There just aren't very many prisons for women.
No.
And so you have to just jam women into these existing places because you're not going to build any more prisons for women. If you build more prisons, they're going to be
for
men.
They're going to fill them. Or they're going to build them for both and then fill them up. Instead, we should just stop building prisons. But
so
again,
when you can send a man to any one of three dozen prisons, but you can send a woman to any one of three or four around America, you're just going to jam them in there until you can't stuff anymore.
But as a reminder of why we're talking about this, Biden was someone who spoke about, who advocated for, and then voted for the 1994 crime bill, which really, truly kicked off what became huge mass incarceration in this country.
Yeah, that's why we are talking about it. And Professor Dickinson, you know, starting in the year 2000, the number of people going to prison increased every year, it increased more for women. More women per annum were
absolutely
incarcerated
right.
Starting in 2000. Go ahead.
That's absolutely right. And I think this is related to our Biden conversation too, right? At a minimum, we're talking 90% of women who are incarcerated have experienced some form of intimate partner violence. And as Nicole was saying, many of them are there for defending themselves against that violence. And so there's a real interesting tension here where, right, Joe Biden is still claiming he's good for women, despite all the things we've talked about, because he was one of the authors of the Violence Against Women Act. I will just say an act that somehow, and we can talk about this, like remains contested today. And yet that one of the places in which we could be doing real meaningful work in relation to violence against women would be to understand that incarcerating survivors, ending that abuse to prison pipeline is one of the most important things we can do to address domestic violence, incarceration, and the rights for working class women.
I want to turn, because we're talking about Biden in this half an hour as it pertains to women, let's internationalize this thing too. I went to Iraq multiple times, you know, starting in 1990 through the 1990s. I went right before the Iraq war. Biden supported the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Now, all Iraqis suffered as a consequence of the war. 1 million Iraqis are presumed dead, according to the Lancet Medical Journal, who would not have otherwise died except for this illegal war of aggression. But the other thing is, the Iraqi society was very advanced in the Middle East in terms of its treatment of and conditions for and status of women.
Absolutely right.
I mean, when I went the first time in 2000, I was shocked that women basically, even though it's in the Middle East, were enjoying a lot of the same social rights and status as women in Western countries regarding just their ability to be in employment and family and life and society. That got smashed. That was crushed.
Well, and that's not how the war was pitched, of course, right? There was all this humanitarian framing around how we had to go to the Middle East to save brown women, right? And so not only is a society smashed and we know the impacts of war on women are disproportionate, but the alibi was helping women out.
Yeah, and now we have religious parties who are basically the ruling parties in Baghdad. That's not going to be good for women in terms of personal, individualized choices.
And why do we have religious parties? Just real quick, John. Yeah. Because the U.S. wrote the Constitution for Iraq.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, because the U.S. did not. The U.S. wanted to divide the country along sectarian lines, which meant you have, and also the Ba'athist Party, whatever, and we have many, you know, profound criticisms of what happened. It was based on a separation of church and state, so to speak, a separation from mosque and state. That was a big principle of pan-Arabism. That's been done away with.
Yes.
That's been done away with. We have 1 minute left. Professor Dickinson, again, what's going on in Geneva right now? What's the Geneva Women's Assembly? Let's take us out with that. What's going on?
That's a great question. So I mentioned this last week. One of the things we're working really hard on is fighting a rural hospital closure. They're trying to close the inpatient mental health unit there in a county that is suffering massively from the opioid crisis, in which children have no access to psychiatric care. And I will just add, at the same time, that our right-wing elected officials are up in arms about the possibility that there might be prison closures in upstate New York. And so we've got this really interesting way in which we can't manage funding for mental health in rural places, and yet the political fight is about keeping prisons open when, just as Nicole was saying, we could be closing those prisons and bringing some resources to address a serious mental health crisis.
Good point, John. I wanted to start our show at one point with the moniker that today and every day there will be 80,000 human beings in solitary confinement in U.S. prisons.
Right.
That's the reality. Those have to be shut down. The prisons should be shut down. Anyway, we're going to keep this discussion going. We were joined by Hannah Dickinson, who is a professor. She is also an organizer with the Geneva Women's Assembly. Professor Dickinson joins us every week from Geneva, New York. And we were joined here in studio by Nicole Russell, a Sputnik news analyst and a producer of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Daniel joins us from San Francisco. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The ETF tax dodge. This loophole lets investors save big. What's this story?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this some. I think in general, when people hear that, you know, financial institutions and corporations don't pay taxes or get preferential treatment in taxes, they kind of generally understand that. But I think it's really important for us to dig in and understand exactly what that looks like and what it means. So Bloomberg had an excellent article on this where they talked about these funds that how they basically avoid paying billions of dollars in taxes by really kind of shuffling money around. And so I want to talk about that in a little more detail, because how it works is, if you're an investor and you have stock and the stock goes up in value and then you sell it for cash, right? That's called a profit. You've made a profit and you get taxed on that profit. Now, first of all, if you're a worker and you work and make money that way, you're going to pay 30 to 35%. It's pretty darn high. If you're an investor and you hold that stock for a year or more, you only pay about 15%. So right away, just by the pure virtue of the fact that you didn't make money by working, you made money by holding something, you get a better stock rate. But it gets worse than that, than just the 15%. So what it turns out is there was this little tax loophole that was written to the law by Nixon way back when he was president. And it didn't really influence things much and wasn't really used all that much. And so everybody kind of ignored it. And what it said is, if you are a fund manager and you have all these stocks and you take some stocks that have increased in value, and instead of cashing them out for cash, you give them to a broker who is withdrawing them from his account to kind of balance your accounts, that it doesn't really count as profit and it doesn't count as something that's being taxed. So that didn't happen very much and it didn't impact things, so people kind of ignored it. But in modern times, in the last 15, 20 years, what these different funds have done is taken advantage of it. And how it goes is this. If they buy a whole bunch of stock, let's say they buy stock in company A, and it goes up in price, and now they want to realize that value. But if they sell it, they're going to have to pay taxes, 15% or more. They don't want to do that. So what they have happened is a bank will deposit an equivalent amount of stock with them of the same type. So more, another tranche, if you will, of stock for company A. They'll keep it at this brokerage firm for about 2 days, 3 days. Lawyers said that they didn't want it to be 1 day because that might look too much like tax evasion. So they said 2 days or 3 days was probably a little better. So it sits in the account for 2 or 3 days, and then the bank withdraws it. But here's the thing. The broker then takes the old stock, the one that went up in value, and gives it to the bank to settle its account and keeps the new deposit of the exact same type of stock. And then, because it hasn't gone up in value hardly at all, because they've only had that tranche of stock for about 2 or 3 days, they sell it and realize that profit. And that allows them to say, essentially, they haven't made hardly any money because the value has only gone up a tiny bit, or maybe even down a little bit in 3 days. What that means is there's an index fund called SPDR, or SPDR, which follows the Standard & Poor's index. It's a huge index fund. It's massive. It's a brand name. Everybody knows SPDR. And it just follows the S&P 500. And it goes up when it goes up, and it goes down when it goes down. It's been around for 22 years. It's made billions of dollars. It has never paid taxes because it uses this particular method to avoid having to pay them by shuffling them around. And that's insane. That would be like hearing, you know, Apple has never paid a single dime of taxes. And in some cases, they haven't. We can talk about that later. But that there's this massive wealth-producing fund, and they use a simple shuffling of money that under the law is acceptable, and they don't pay taxes on it.
So what they're doing is they're making these large transactions basically not in cash. Is that part of this then?
Exactly. It's not in cash. It's in shares instead of cash. And because it's in shares and because you're technically giving it away to another entity, in this case, a bank, typically, it's not considered realizing a profit. You're just giving away shares. It's only when they become cash that it's a profit. And that distinction, that little legal distinction, allows them to turn new shares of exactly the same type into cash and pay, you know, very small amounts of taxes.
Now, if you give someone a gift, since we're giving things away here, let's say it's in cash. The annual gift exclusion amount, I think, is $15,000 or
right.
Something. Right. After that, like if I gave you, John, $15,000 right. Or $14,999,
you're okay.
I'm okay. But if I give you more than that, it's taxable.
Yes.
Is that right, Daniel?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right. So what you're saying basically is these transactions are doing things using the issue of giving or gifting. In a way that would be completely not accessible for us as normal human beings.
Yeah, if you have money, this is a kind of a neat little taxable dance, untaxable rather.
It's a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's what they call them, heartbeats, because they happen really quickly, one after the other. And I think, you know, the gifting is a good comparison about it. But I think we'd also go further is these transactions only happen between these large fund managers and banks. Normal people cannot get in on them whatsoever. You have to have billions of dollars to be able to do this. And they're not interested in doing it with someone like you or I. you know, and it goes to the idea, even when I go back to talking about the 15% tax on capital gains, that making money isn't equal. When I work hard to produce a good or service that enriches society, that benefits people, maybe I cut hair, maybe I grow oranges, maybe I build houses, I have to pay more back to society. But a financial institution, a speculator that does nothing other than put money in a place and it's an electronic blip, sit on it, and then blip again and take it back out, they have to give less back to society. That somehow that movement of electronic blips has benefited society more than the person creating oranges, such that they don't have to give back as much. And really, it kind of shows the domination of capital and banking, because a lot of times we kind of ask, you know, who runs the world or who's in charge here? And we'd like to think, oh, it's the Senate or it's Congress or whatever. But the truth is, financial institutions are the king of the heap. They're the ones that write these laws. They make sure they're very complex. They make sure they're not really well understood or well talked about, so that people generally don't oppose them because they don't even realize they're kind of going on. And they make billions of dollars quietly off to the side while the rest of society, growing oranges and cutting hair, has to pay in to the system, to pay into the society that they help build.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talk to him every Tuesday about big issues of the economy. I'm looking, Daniel, at Fortune magazine. You know, John, we talk about Fortune. It is the capitalist tool, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's what they say. That's their advertising moniker. Is it Forbes or Fortune? Walter thinks it's The Economist. I don't know. Do you know, Daniel?
I don't, unfortunately, off the top of my head. But I think they'd agree with it regardless.
By the time we finish our show, we're gonna educate ourselves and thus our audience. Anyway, I'm looking at Fortune magazine, which was my main point. The headline commentary: Apple avoided $40 billion in taxes. Now it wants a gold star. This article was written about 14 months ago. Listen to this. The public relations spin doctors are working overtime at Apple this week. The tech giant just announced that it will pay $38 billion to the U.S. Treasury in taxes brought home from overseas and, quote, create, close quote, some 20,000 new jobs.
Oh, yeah.
It pledged to invest $350 billion in the United States over the next 5 years and give employees $2,500 in restricted stock units. That's all spin. What Apple really unveiled were plans to collect a massive windfall from the GOP's corporate tax handout. This was a pay-to-play political scam at its ugliest, and the rest of us are the chumps. Let's start with the dollars. Apple currently holds about $252 billion in profits offshore, where it can avoid paying U.S. taxes. That's over 90% of the company's total cash on hand. This profit is subject to the corporate income tax as soon as it's, quote, repatriated back to the United States. Before the recent tax code overhaul, the company would have paid $78.6 billion in taxes if it brought the money home, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Apple didn't want to pay this tax, so it let the cash sit offshore. In the meantime, Apple and its peers have been working furiously to tilt the tax code in their favor. Apple spent $2.3 million in the third quarter of 2017 alone lobbying the other four big tech companies. Microsoft, Facebook, Alphabet, which owns Google, and Amazon chipped in another $14 million. And finally, for their efforts, these titans of Silicon Valley are being rewarded handsomely. Now their offshore profits will be taxed at a one-time 15.5% repatriation rate, also called a tax holiday, and all other corporate profits will be taxed at 21%, down from the previous nominal rate of 35%. I mean, this is tax dodging like you can't believe.
And they make it legal.
It's legal, and they're all fine, and all of their CEOs are owning like dozens of mansions. Again, this isn't just benign corporate earnings. These people are profiting handsomely. Anyway, Daniel, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's really the kind of incestuous nature between the state and capital in this case, where you have the Trump administration giving them this handout, right? They knew full well that these were some of the companies that would benefit much from that tax holiday because they knew they kept most of their money quotes in Ireland, you know, in their Irish entities where they get huge tax breaks. But the truth is, it wasn't really in Ireland. It was in banks in the United States. It's just the corporate entities were in Ireland. So technically, the ownership was Irish. And so Trump knew that this would benefit Apple and others like it. And of course, he's on this big tear to create jobs. So Apple gets this huge, you know, free giveaway from Trump, and then it returns the favor. And how does it return the favor? It makes this big trumpeting cry about how, look, we're creating jobs. You know how the president is death on creating jobs and jobs, jobs, jobs? Well, look what we're doing. We're creating all these jobs for them. So everyone should be so grateful, should be so happy that we got this huge tax break, because we'll let a small, minuscule trickle of it trickle down to the employees we're claiming that we're going to hire for this. But the truth is, they haven't been paying taxes for years, and they are just deciding to move it now because the rate is so absurdly low. I mean, remember, it said 22% on the nominal rate and then a 15 for moving it over. 22%, no worker makes 22% on their tax rates. You know what I mean? We pay way more in taxes. But if you make money as a corporation, then you get a 22%. I mean, I've often joked with my boss that I should open an LLC, and he should hire the LLC who will contract the work out to me, and then I'll pay 22%. And I'll still come to the office just the same and work on my computer and blah, blah, blah. But now suddenly I'll get a different tax rate because I have this little legal entity. And that's what we're seeing here, that huge tax holiday that they're getting. And what it means basically is that they owe less to society, is what we're saying, is that by having them pay less into the society that created and produced the workers, that create the obscene, fantastic wealth for Apple and others, for some reason, Apple doesn't owe that society. Apple owes it less, and Apple doesn't need to buy into the housing and the schools and the healthcare and the education and all that that produce, you know, the people and the experts that make it fantastically rich. And that's ridiculous, because they owe it perhaps even more, because these workers were the ones that created their wealth. And so you see this corrupt relationship between the current administration and Apple, where the administration giveth Apple a whole bunch of money, and then Apple goes on a PR campaign for Trump so that he can look like he's some kind of brilliant job creator.
I think that's exactly right. Hey, I want to ask you about something that you flagged for us as well. I have a friend who was instrumental in bringing down Bernie Madoff, the famous Ponzi schemer, Harry Markopoulos. And Harry, being a whistleblower, this is typical among whistleblowers. You can't really find a great job working for another company. In most cases, you can't find any job working for another company. So he went into business for himself, investigating Ponzi schemes and then reporting those Ponzi schemes to the SEC. You have flagged an article for us from the Wall Street Journal, two of them actually, from the Wall Street Journal, talking about a GE executive who had to pay for knowingly facilitating a Ponzi scheme versus a Chinese regulatory head who went to prison for accepting bribes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, definitely. So General Electric finance unit. So General Electric actually has a banking arm. So they're not just creating light bulbs. They're doing a lot of other things.
And they make a lot of money from that banking arm too, by the way. They finance everything.
Absolutely. And that shows the transition, you know, of kind of traditional manufacturing capital to banking capital, which is what we see now. And GE is definitely very much a part of it. And they make a lot of money from their finance side. So their finance side had to pay $49 million. And why did it have to do that? It was a fine because an individual who, his name is Barry Mukamal, ripped off a whole bunch of investors, some of them large hedge funds, by basically running a Ponzi scheme. It started in 98, and what he was claiming to do was buying merchandise and reselling it to Costco at a markup, and he was able to get the merchandise very, very cheap and profit off of that. And so he got investors to back him. GE gave him some loans as well so that he could purchase those so-called, you know, discounted merchandise and resell to Costco. He had collateral as well. He provided them a lot of financial statements and documents to secure these loans. Well, about 2 years later in 2000, that shows that the executives at GE became aware of the Ponzi. They became aware that the documents were forged, that the collateral that was supposedly securing the loans didn't exist. And they became aware that basically this guy was just ripping people off. So what did they do? Well, they didn't want to go to the regulators and cry out, because if the regulators clamped down on him, everyone would lose their money, including GE, because they'd realize there wasn't any there. So what GE did is they kept quiet. They shut up, basically, and said, we're not going to loan you any more money. You got to pay us all back, but we're going to keep quiet about it. So GE got its money back, including the interest, And then it was the hedge funds and others and all the investors that lost their shirts. I think $650 million, if I'm not mistaken. And what it shows is that these two executives, you know, knowingly assisted in the facilitation of a Ponzi scheme to protect themselves and to basically make their money back. And so they had to pay some $49 million. Now, $49 million is nothing to sneeze at, but of course, GE makes ridiculous amounts of money. And of course, these executives weren't personally liable, right? They didn't pay their $49 million. They paid it out of a legal settlement fund at General Electric and probably, you know, continued on their way. Maybe they lost their jobs, although it doesn't mention that. And I'm sure they can get, you know, work elsewhere and make obscene amounts of money. So what it shows is really you just kind of pay off or write a check. And I don't know how much money GE made off of that Ponzi scheme. So for all we know, they might have actually come out ahead after all said and done. The article doesn't report exactly how much it was made. But now there's a big, you know, kerfuffle and a lawsuit. So, okay, that sort of story is very common in the United States. We hear it all the time. Executives behave in corrupt ways, rip people off, and then they pay a fine and they go on and nothing happens. Turn to China, because I wanted to highlight this. There's a Chinese regulator that's in charge of internet regulation. And what he was basically convicted of was accepting bribes from big tech companies. And while China hasn't named the companies, they have a lot of strong alleging that it was Facebook or Apple, or suggesting that it was Facebook and Apple and other ones. And he was essentially getting big bribes from them to lower regulatory standards for them, to make exceptions for them so that they could get in there. So corrupt, right? Corrupt, just like the GE officials who allowed people to get ripped off so that they wouldn't lose any money. He enriched himself in his particular position. Well, the current president in China, Xi Jinping, is in a big terror to crack down and clamp down on corruption, which he sees as a huge threat in China, and he's really aggressively been going after various officials. That includes this guy. This guy was convicted in court. He confessed, so he pled guilty, and he'll be serving 14 years in prison, as well as paying out about $500,000 in fines. But even with the guilty plea, he's still serving serious jail time. And I like to talk, you know, people like to talk about human rights violations in China and criticize China, you know, at this terrible place. But they will actually punish corrupt business leaders and wealthy officials when they engage in bad stuff. I would have loved to see those GE executives go to jail for 14 years or at all. And you're not going to see a clampdown or a stop in this sort of corrupt practices in the U.S. until you actually see jail time. Because for as much money as they make, they can write a check. It's no problem. I kind of wanted to contrast that to say such things are possible. People can be held accountable, and they do get held accountable. And we need to seriously consider doing the same thing here in the United States.
You know, it's some kind of a weird cultural thing, I think, inside the Justice Department, where they will come down on you like a ton of bricks if you violate even the most obscure federal statute. But if your crime has something to do with banking or finance, you're going to get off. You know, you may have to pay some restitution. You may pay a fine. You may even have your license suspended, but you're probably not going to go to prison. That's something I've never understood.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to what I said before, that when we talk about kind of who's in charge here, who's making decisions, it's the finance industry. It's the banking industry. I remember they had this very poignant picture of Elizabeth Warren yelling at the then CEO of Wells Fargo, John Stumpf. He's not the CEO anymore. He stepped down. And in fact, Wells Fargo just lost their replacement CEO as well, Tim Sloan. So they're just kind of going through him. And, you know, she was hammering him over the fact that Wells Fargo opened up more than 3 million fake accounts, as it should be. And of course, she's in this kind of higher up position on this bench, a little bit like a judge, and he's kind of down there looking castigated and whatnot. But the truth is, that's just political theater. That's just showmanship. Because, yes, she's on a higher position and got to yell at him, but John Stumpf quit and got $250 million parachute. And that's it. That's what happened, right? So Elizabeth Warren wasn't able to imprison him, wasn't able to prevent him from receiving money, wasn't able to prevent him from enjoying a fabulously wealthy lifestyle that we could only possibly dream of. She wasn't able to do anything. All she could do is yell at him. So, you know, sticks and stones, as the expression goes. But that shows really who's in charge here and who's making decisions.
I think that's right. Hey, I want to move over to another issue that we've hinted at over the last couple of weeks here on the show. But I want to talk about it in more depth. And that is the Sackler family. The Sackler family has made millions, perhaps billions of dollars on the manufacture of opioids. And just now, the Sacklers are being boycotted. There are museums to which they have been very generous in the past who now want nothing to do with them. It's all about opioids. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the Sackler House of Cards is finally collapsing. They got fantastically wealthy producing OxyContin and many of its derivatives as pain management, and aggressively sold them, hopped over regulatory hurdles, were adamant that it was non-addictive, that it was relatively harmless, that if you use it consistent with how doctors are prescribing it, you're going to be fine. And of course, what we've seen is opioid addiction ravaging the United States. I mean, just destroying whole communities as people fall prey to it. It's gotten to a degree of egregiousness that, elected officials and others can't ignore it. It's proverbial that things like OxyContin, ruined lives and claimed many of them. And so now, of course, everybody's going after the Sackler family and picking them apart. And you'll find with any serious dynasty like this major multi-billion-dollar family, there is a tremendous amount of corruption that goes on within it. What you're seeing here is when Purdue Pharma is ultimately the company that produced OxyContin, when the cracks in the armor started appearing and the Sackler family started realizing Purdue Pharma's toast, that, it's going to get lawsuited and sued into oblivion. They started funneling money out of it because they knew that creditors, especially, and the victims, the survivors of the opioid crisis and their families would be suing them. They started funneling money out of it to protect Purdue from getting it seized through these legal actions. And so they used a complex network of corporate entities, as they always do. They hop it from ADC Corp to XYZ Corp to this one to that one. But ultimately, the money, after hopping several times, finds its way into the pockets of the Sackler family. And what they're being accused of now is not just, rampant deaths through the opioid crisis. They're also being accused of fraud. Because this is a form of fraud where if you know you're going to go bankrupt, if you know a company's insolvent before other people do, and you start taking all your money out of it to prevent it from getting seized, that's a crime. We'll see if it sticks. New York AG is going after him pretty aggressively, which matters. Certainly New York's attorney general is no one to sneeze at. And it looks like other states are going to be jumping in as well. And they'll be the kind of next to get attacked. Now, we'll see what happens, right? I kind of compare what the Sacklers did to sort of like when the drug lords know that the feds are closing in on them and they take all the cash out of their safe and throw it in a duffel bag and run away, to kind of before the feds get there and the safe's empty. It's kind of like that, because that's exactly what Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family is responsible for a massive narco state, if you will, that they created throughout the United States. We often look down on Latin America as being victim to all these drug lords and drug czars that abuse their communities and are making them hopelessly corrupt. And yet that's exactly what's happening here. They were able to game the system and corrupt the system such that people could be issued dangerous, hyper-addictive drugs so that they can make, obscene amounts of money. And so we'll see how it all shakes out. This goes back to the Chinese official going to jail for 14 years. It would be nice if we saw jail time for the Sackler family for the lives they ruined. I wouldn't hold my breath. They'll probably have to pay some big fines and they'll have their names smeared all over the front page. But I think at the end of the day, they'll be able to go back to their mansions and think about what they did on their yachts, as they watch sunsets and things like that.
Yeah, I think they probably will go back to their mansions and generally live happily ever after. But every time we read one of their obituaries, it's going to say that so-and-so was a part of the family that got the entire country addicted to opioids. And maybe there's some satisfaction in that. Our last issue, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I want you to talk about Pacific Gas and Electric and the dividends that they're paying or not paying.
Yeah, so the next chapter in the saga of PG&E that was responsible for burning down huge portions of California, including the many small towns, which now don't exist anymore, and not even small, actually, mid-sized towns that don't exist anymore. A judge in Northern California is attempting to freeze the ability for PG&E to pay dividends to its investors. So PG&E, in spite of everything that's happened, in spite of all the lives being lost, all the destruction being caused, is still trying to pay out dividends to its investors, is still trying to take its money and give it to the wealthy that invest with them. And some of their biggest investors, of course, are the executives at PG&E who own significant portions of shares and are enjoying those dividends. So after all this happened, after all the insanity and all the lives lost, what we're seeing right now is PG&E trying to squeeze its last bits of profit, give it to the executives before, they probably bring the hammer down and smother it in bankruptcy and lawsuits. There's a judge that's attempting to prevent this. And the way it's being presented in the mainstream media is that this is all very controversial and he might be overstepping his bounds. And this is an unheard of legal precedent to that prevent them from profiting. which I really think goes to show the kind of nature of the system. You know, PG&E's responsibility is to create, you know, essential service to promote and foster human life. And instead, what they did is they destroyed many human lives, tens of thousands of them at least, and created an environmental crisis. And yet, they still have a right to pay out those dividends to their investors and to their owners. And the fact that we might prevent them from doing that so that that money instead could go to the victims is considered kind of controversial. And this judge might not even be able to do it. We'll see how it goes. It's just being floated as an idea at this point. I hope it's successful. I hope it goes through. But it takes something absurdly ridiculous like this huge environmental crisis for the legal, you know, powers that be to actually act and be able to hold these companies accountable in at least some minor way. So I certainly hope it happens. I'm definitely in the judge's corner on this one. And I think, you know, PG&E should, executives should kind of go to the same way as our Chinese regulator that's serving 14 years, but we'll see. And for now, PG&E continues to be trying to push its profits to its executives in spite of all the lives it's destroyed.
Well, I think one of the things I would like to watch too is whether or not PG&E's executives get their annual bonuses after all these people have died and have lost their homes. But we'll leave it there. We were happy to be joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst, and he joins us every week on Tuesday to talk about the economy. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear. Thank you.